I'm about this height. First of all, thank you, Sue. Thank you to Paul, who's currently on the Troubadour, I believe.
Yes, he is.
And it's just really lovely to be in Cork. If anybody was looking for us earlier, you've got Dean Brown to blame. He had us out to have I thought that it would be somewhat interesting to read a couple of poems, maybe two, that weren't by me. I came in at about 9:45 here, and the five-word challenge was going on. One of the words was mold, and one of the words was daft. So I thought that in my place as an editor, occasionally, I should read two poems by other people that feature the words mold and daft. This is Obad with Quince Pace and Stilton by Padraig Regan, which is in Delicious. It's not to plug it too much, but it's on sale from us. Obad with Quince Pace and Stilton. How might I account for this amplitude of pink? As I understand it, a quince's rind is yellow. Its innards, when exposed, are yellow-white. It is 3 days after my 22nd birthday, and I'm sitting at the kitchen table, spreading quince paste over wheat germ crackers, and trying to work out some reason, some logic for this cerise. The cheese, I comprehend. The cheese is blue, because during the maturation process, its crust was pierced, and the entry points colonized by mold, and yes, it accents the paste beautifully. But this, I suspect, is just coincidental and doesn't answer anything, really. I go back to bed and dream about walking through a hailstorm of miraculous metals. That's about Padraig Regan. This poem is by Scott McHenry, who was set to be here but had to go to a conference instead. His loss. This is in a little book that I put together with Sinead Morrissey. This is in the voice of Marianne McCracken. I'm sure most of you know who Marianne McCracken is. It's called Waiting for the Ionians, and that's somewhat in reference to some idea of Belfast at some point, perhaps ironically being referred to as the Athens of the North. Gentlemen of the Kirk, we are not deaf. We hear your murmurs during psalms, your quarrels in the vestry before and after every sermon, the final words of those brusquely ended sentences. If we are deaf, we are deaf as the harpists are blind. And we are not blind, gentlemen. We have seen the pikes in the crypt, the muskets in the loft, the shafts fixed under the benches of the nave. We intercept your letters written in terrible French. If we are blind, we are blind as the harpists are blind. Spouses, fathers, brothers, we are not daft. We know what goes on in the kitchen, yet still the door is slammed shut in our faces. Like we hold out the fruit of moderation that will get your Irish heirs expelled. If we are daft, we are daft, like the Lamb of God is daft. I quite like whatever this music is going on in the background. So I thought I should read a poem that references a little bit of Bob Dylan, a little bit of Van Morrison. Fly. Do you remember that time we were so high up in the old library tower that every planned task disappeared? Books piled up and we passed notes from palm to palm under our plywood desk. Or that night you told me I turned you on to Bob Dylan. Or was it Van Morrison's Moondance? Was it your place or mine? or the first time we met in the cafe when I was single. That guilt-free day, I turned up early, bought you green tea on a tip-off from a mutual friend, then watched the familiar walls lose their shape, my heart a steak on the table, my coffee going cold. Next poem I'll read is a version of a poem by Seana Reardon. I was shown the poem by Kieran Carson. Everybody and their granny has had a version of this poem. Mine is called An Exchange. You cannot know the half of it, said Turnbull, until you've seen this horse's dark, sad eyes. And you yourself would be as dark and sad if your feet stood under you like sleepers under track. And I could see that Turnbull too had got his fill of something from those dark, sad eyes, into which he gazed for so long he'd lost his step and slipped headlong into the horse's mind. And so I turned my eyes towards the horse, in hope of gleaning from those dark, sad eyes some hint of what it was he saw, but in their place were Turnbull's eyes sunk heavy in the horse's head. I turned to look at Turnbull once again, and then I saw in Turnbull's face the two spilling eyes, yet that yes were dark and dumb and sad, the horse's eyes. Another exchange. The heavy door was open. I was a sinner, a simple country person, the least of all believers, but something of his boyish face was easing from the off. His boyish face that flickered in relief against the wall, his boyish hands sleek as polished glass. Music played allegro as the moon made its slow advance through the skylight across the floor where, as instructed, I placed a turnip at his feet, whereupon his sleek boyish hands and quick boyish tongue were moved to act, his voice becoming my voice, his hands becoming my hands, as he carved from the turnip my father the deacon's face. He told me what I had to hear, and I was quick to mention war, whereupon his boyish eyes receded far beyond the night. I was about 16 at the time. So we touch a St. Patrick in me. The next poem. It's not that my pronunciation as Gaelicha is atrocious. It's not that I went to a school called Belfast Royal Academy. this is just Carrick Fergus Irish in the pronunciation. I don't have to say that anywhere else. Put him in Cork. I think I spotted Pat Collar, haven't I? Hey, Pat. I'll read this one for you. It's a nice cheery one. Pat put this in poetry. Finnish of Reigach. In April 1607, the village of Finnish of Reigach was hit by an unidentified disease, taking the lives of all the villagers. The village was razed and official records expunged. In 2007, an account written by the local undertaker was found buried in the roots of a tree in the quarantine village's square, which unearthed details of this disaster. They sent a horse along the roads to say our town had been closed in. Its bloodied hooves had been unshod. The shoes were kept to save the iron or bless the fate of those who stayed across the glens or down the coast. This horse's message came our way while sentries occupied their posts. The note was tied around its neck, declaring death was soon to reach, where all would feel its fevered knock, the butcher's shop, the mill, the church. The harnessed village men played tough until the store of ale ran dry. The women stopped their mouths with cloth and held their husbands as they died. Disease took hold with sudden force. We thought that we could hush the moan so skinned and burned the flagging horse, and let the fire consume its bones. My children's skin turned cold and flushed. Acquainted as I was with death, I saw their end and held their trust. So cut their throats and sucked their breath. I dug their graves and then some more. I don't want to end on this note. A few years ago I got my Twitter fight. completely surprising. But somebody had a bit of a go at me for being a little bit, I don't know what we're having a go at me for, but I remembered that the best response to anybody saying that you're a bit camp, that you're a bit whatever, the best person to ever do that was Catullus. Catullus 16. Begins with Petacabo ego vos eramabo. I don't translate it as disgustingly as it can be translated, but I call this a rebuke. Slap it up, you big mouth pricks. Mouth breather Aurelius and shite hawk furious. You who shout that because my bones don't gulder, aren't notable, I don't give a shit. You know, it's only right that a poet cares about stuff. But poems need not be so brash. Maybe it's the fact that a little thought can go a long way. That you can be subtle and maybe, just maybe, still say something. Not just to kids like you, but people, yeah, people, who haven't yet hardened. Because I write sonnets or wee stanzas, you think it's cool to say I'm not a man? Slap it up, you big mouth pricks. So it's not to end on that note. I'll read, you know, I'll read what's essentially a love poem for a man. And I'll read it for Dean Brown. But maybe there's something a bit questionably macho about this poem. Somehow I don't think so. This is about, I guess, one of the literary greats of the 1990s. He was French, but produced his best work first in Leeds and then in Manchester. Eric Cantona.
Oh, yes.
Eric Cantona enters the cafe you work in, wearing a cravat, and you almost genuflect. Remembering how you wore the collar up under school polo shirt for a whole year. Eric Cantona, taller than you imagined, takes a seat, draws a volume of Rambo from an attaché case. Cantona says, garçon, and you splutter like a fool and say, pardon. Taking his order with peppermint tea, which until now has never made you think of wintergreen and the pinkness of flesh on March mornings. Eric Cantona's mouth mimics the words he reads. You bring his tea and say you loved his part in Elizabeth. Eric Cantona's reply is exquisitely gracious. You feel his grace in it. Eric Cantona with a brow like an ox, giving off the glow of Eric Cantona. You whisper, exit Eric Cantona, as Eric plants his things and leaves.